wake you up. Nothing will, I'll tell you that. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Incidentally, that's the prelude, Wagner's prelude to the Wedding March. We hear Rite of the Valkyries all the time, so I figured we'd switch over to something else a little bit. And I surely like that movement right there. Yeah, Wagner's Prelude to the Wedding March. Yeah. If you go a little farther in the track, you'll get the Wedding March. But I didn't want any of you young guys to take off running, man, out the door. I ain't getting married. Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network. And we're in the heartland. Yeah, white heartland this morning. Snow on the ground. It's snowing right now again. Yes, it is. In the bunker, too, down here where it's safe and sound and bulletproof. Man, I think we're even artillery-proof down here. Yes, we are. Our address is P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And you could send your questions and your letters and your bitches and everything else to that P.O. Box. You could send your orders. Send your orders to resist. No, I'm sorry. Send your orders to merchandise at resist.com. However, if you're wanting the Nature's Eternal Religion and the White Man's Bible, and the other one, let's see, Nazi Virus, order those from right here in Fallbrook. I mean, Fallbrook, jeez. Been out of there about 3 or 4 years, and I'm still using Fallbrook. But anyhow, send those to Warsaw. But everything else, send to merchandise at resist.com. And any questions you've got about anything on the website, communicate with merchandise at resist.com. If you see a glitch or a problem, yesterday we had an email that was finding a little bit of a problem to get the free radio shows. Well, I told them that you've got the radio club up at the top. If you go down, scroll down a little bit more, you'll see radio programs, and that's the one you get. But since it did seem to be a reasonable request, I put the free radio label up above the on the column up above the radio club, so you won't have any problem finding the free radios. And our December radio shows will be up there pretty soon. Webmaster had a little bit of problem with the program, so. But anyhow, all you guys, you know, we're giving you these free radio shows, but I know there's a hell of a lot of you downloading them out there. There's hundreds of shows. So, you know, it'd only be an honorable that you contribute a little money once in a while. We're not forcing anybody to do that, but we're saying that with that many people downloading free radio shows, it wouldn't hurt you to drop us a $5 or $10 once in a while. And that'll make everybody happy. And, of course, thank you to all our regular radio club subscribers who are very supportive and have done very well over the last couple of years, and we get along fine. Yes, we do. Well, let's see here. It's January the 6th, 2009. 2008's gone, boys. You didn't do it. Whatever you thought you might want to do in 2008, it's gone. It's too late. Never going to be again. Yeah, throughout eternity, there's not going to be a 2008 again. So you got another chance. It's 2009. So if you're going to do it in 2009, you got quite a bit of time, but you better get started early. Well, I heard on the radio today that the Jew radio that Obama's daughters went to school yesterday, their first day at school, in a private school in Bethesda, Maryland, not in Washington, D.C. How come none of these president's kids ever go to school in Washington, D.C.? That's the capital of the country. I mean, right down the road from the White House. Why is that? And another thing, a little bit different than usual, they had a bulletproof Humvee taking them to school with a bunch of security cars. Wonder why is that? What the hell's this thing? I mean, you know, I thought that he was voted in with this overwhelming acclamation. And I wouldn't think anybody would be upset with Obama. Yeah. So, anyhow, how would you like to be one of those kids going to school in a damn Humvee, bulletproof, rocketproof Humvee? Wouldn't that sort of mess up your psyche? You say, but Daddy, Daddy, I thought they all loved us. So anyhow, there they go, off to a probably predominantly white school in Bethesda. Now I wonder, if you're a black working person out there, and you see this kind of shit, and you think, well, Glass, we got ourselves a man in the White House. He gonna really lift us up out of the muck and the mire. But wait a minute, wait a minute. He don't want to have his kids mingling with the brothers and the sisters. He sent them kids way out there to Bethesda, Maryland, you know, where all those military people are and everything else. And I heard that school was mostly white, maybe a few Asians in there, maybe a few, might be a few more Obama-type half-breeds. But I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have voted for that guy. Well, you got to understand, Mr. Black Man, your best friend to get Obama in was Bush. Without Bush screwing everything up, everything, from war to economy to everything, it wasn't for Bush and his party, the Republicrats, there would be no Obama in the White House. They wouldn't have had a chance. You know, Obama got an overwhelming vote here in Indiana. Indiana hasn't voted Democrat for so damn long nobody can remember. And they sure wouldn't have voted for him if they'd had any kind of choice. I think the Democrats owe everything right now to Bush. And they're just thrilled to death. But still, there's a lot of people out there. I hear the Republican, they had a big meeting yesterday and trying to get two black guys elected to the top of the Republican Party. I knew that's what they're going to do because they had a meeting about 3 weeks ago, and they're going to really go full bore to get the Negroes into the Republican Party and get the Mexicans in there and everything else. Instead of circling the wagons and developing a hardcore above ground party with a iron fist underground, they're going to make the proverbial mistake and try to simply outdo the Democrats. The Democrats have such a lead on them as far as recruiting all this wretched refuse that Republicans haven't got a chance of catching up. They could do about anything. They're not going to catch up with the Democrats as far as appealing to the wretched refuse. So there the Republicans are, screwing up with Bush. And now they're going to screw up some more by trying to go farther, farther, farther over there. Please, Mr. Black Man, will you join our party? We'll make you the head of the party. We'll make you the chief of the chief, man. And you Mexicans, come on into our Republican Party. Save our ass. We'll treat you good. We'll stomp out all those middle states, those white state people, those backward hillbilly people that don't know shit from Chinola. We never liked them anyhow. Yeah, damn... poor lower middle class people, white people. We fooled them for a long time, but we ain't fooling them no more. So Rastas, you join our party. You join our party, and we'll see that there's a nice blonde baby gal in your bed every night, man. Do that, will you? Well, you wouldn't believe it by listening to me, but we got a guest today, and it's none other than Gorilla Radio Man. Back again. Yeah, and there's a lot cooking. It's interesting to watch the tactical movements of the Hamas. They've changed their tactics all around, and they're taking some of these Israeli Jews out. Yeah, and the Israeli Jews, this is a typical Jew. They took their own guys out with so-called friendly fire. I don't know if getting hit by shell from a tank, I don't think I'd call that friendly fire, but they took out three with one of their own tanks, and they took out a couple of more with some other friendly fire. That's the coolest term, friendly fire. Oh, man. So the Hamas, maybe if the Hamas just go down a tunnel and shut up, the Israelis will end up shooting themselves. You know, maybe they'll wipe themselves out. We'll see. But I think that, the Israelis are playing right into our hands. I love it. I mean, they're becoming even more and more the pariah of the whole world. And the only ones that are backing them up are Christian Zionists and this screwed-up U.S. government. So this is all good news as far as I'm concerned. Everybody's going to end up hating these people. Yeah. And I see the nigger boys burned up about 1,500 cars in Paris. I guess it was on New Year's Eve. And they had 35,000 cops out, and they couldn't stop them, or didn't stop them. Maybe they were protecting them while they burnt the cars. I'd like to be the chief of police over there for one of those nights when the niggers go out there to burn 1,400 cars. Yeah, that would be quite interesting what the results would be, even if I had to go to prison the rest of my life. There wouldn't be a black boy standing. Well, here he is from snow-covered, we'll say Illinois, I guess. Illinois, the land of the incarcerated governors. There he is, Guerrilla Radio Man. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going, Tommy?
Well, it's hanging.
Hey, I guess I missed that on the news. The blacks were burning up cars in Paris on New Year's Eve?
I guess it was New Year's Eve. I didn't pay that much attention to the exact date, but it was not too long ago. I think it was New Year's Eve.
Now, we're not talking about an incident that happened a few years ago when some Moroccan kid got arrested by the police. We're talking about something very recent.
I assumed it was recent. I know they did a lot of that before, but they've been burning up cars, every weekend over there in Paris. That's one of their things, the Muslims. That's how they have fun. You know, they don't go to the movies. They burn cars. Now, if I had a car out on the street and I saw niggers coming to that car, you know what I would do, don't you?
Yeah, I know what you would do.
When they raised their arm with a Molotov cocktail, it'd be the last time they had an arm.
There you go.
I'd be the Clint Eastwood boy, like from Tornado. What's the name of that movie?
Gran Torino.
I got to see that movie. I started out panning it, but everybody says they like it, so I got to go see that. I always liked Clint Eastwood.
Right.
Yeah. Anyhow, maybe somebody will straighten me out on that. But anyhow, it don't make any difference, really, when they did it. It said they had 35,000 cops out to try to stop it. Well, I don't think so. I think they were out there to protect them from... There's got to be people in Paris, white people over there, or even chinks. I mean, it would say bullshit and come out in the street and fight these people.
Right. It's just interesting. I think it's interesting that... You know, when they talk about the crime in America and the crime in big cities and, you know, it's always a black thing. Black and brown thuggery is not an American phenomenon. It's worldwide. You know, look what these Packy gangs are doing in Australia, and that Derek McThomas is right. They need to kill every one of those bastards.
You know, don't be so hard on the thugs, because the thugs have a great history. Did you ever study the history of the thugs over in India?
Oh, the thuggies of India, they were masters of strangulation.
That's right, and they used to lay in wait along the highways and byways and be friendly to the travelers and grab them, choke them, and take their stuff. So tactically, they were pretty effective for a long time. It took them a long time to stomp out the thuggies. So, looking at it from our point of view, I know a lot of people that travel the highways I wouldn't mind strangling.
Right. Hey, speaking of Clint Eastwood, he had a movie on Spike last night called In the Line of Fire. Did you ever see that?
Yes.
Well, I noticed that the John Malkovich, the assassin that was going to kill the president.
I love him. He's great.
Yeah, I know. He's always good. And not that we have any plans on any presidential things, because that's not the problem. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that he constructed a zip gun out of a plastic polymer substance, and he went through security. He had the bullets. It would only fire two bullets. He had the bullets in the spring for the recoil of the weapon. He had those disguised in a rabbit's foot with keys on it, and the other bullet in spring was in a fountain pen. And he put those in the tray, and then he walked through security with the gun, and then he reached around after he went through the checkpoint, and he grabbed his things. He actually got a gun into the convention. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it was. And a lot of interesting things that these writers come up with in the movies that sometimes is worth the price of a ticket, you know?
Well, I tell you what, on January 30th, there's a movie coming out with Liam Neeson, and I guess his daughter is abducted, and he's talking to the people who abducted his daughter. He says, if you let him go right now, nothing will be done about it. You can go your own way. But if you don't, I have a special set of skills that I will use to track you down and kill you. And I guess he's a retired assassin or something. So that movie looks like he may have some ideas.
Yeah, I just received an email yesterday from one of our guys about guerrilla warfare news and views for our readers. This came out of Harvard, Middle East Strategy at Harvard, learning from Hezbollah. Quote, Hezbollah uses a decentralized command structure that allows its subordinate leaders to exercise a high degree of initiative on the battlefield. Similarly, if other guerrilla groups successfully emulate Hezbollah's model, they too will be much more difficult adversaries on the battlefield. And then down here below it says, the amorphous Hezbollah, led by Hassan Nasrallah, represents a rising threat, mixing an organized political movement with decentralized armed cells employing adaptive tactics in ungoverned zones. Hezbollah affirms an emerging trend. Highly disciplined, well-trained, distributing cells can contest modern conventional forces with an admixture of guerrilla tactics and technology in densely packed urban centers. Now, one more thing here.
Interesting.
Mixing an organized political movement with decentralized armed cells employing adaptive tactics in ungoverned cells, Hezbollah. That's the same damn thing. But anyhow, sounds like they're listening to our radio show. You know?
I don't know about that. I mean, that knowledge is out there, and, you know...
Wait a minute. They're getting it from our...
I mean, it is. We're free.
They're getting it from our radio show. They don't know nothing about War to Flee, those ragheads. Anyhow...
I don't know. A lot of them, you know, come to our universities. They get exposed to a lot of stuff.
I'm joshing you, boy. I'm joshing
you. I know.
Well, anyhow, and more good news from Mexico. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, we're all pissed off at the Mexicans, but they're doing some interesting things, the drug cartels. Where is it here? The warning underscores the difficult choices confronting President Felipe Calderon as he takes on drug cartels while weighing the implications of a growing casualties in a war of midterm elections and a slow economy. It also reflects rising concerns among U.S. officials and analysts about the deteriorating Mexican security situation, corruption among Mexico's top crime fighters, and the vulnerability of the military to possible corruption in battling cartel gangs. As the war against cartels escalates in 2009, so will the threats, particularly against U.S. officials and other American officials, analysts, and diplomats, including U.S. Ambassador Tony Garza said in a recent interview. Calderon must and will keep the pressure on the cartels. But anyhow, what was I saying? You know, they're cutting the heads off the soldiers and everything else. But it says up here at the top, drugs are the economic engine for the Mexican insurgency who wishes to dispose of the incumbency of Mexico. This is good material to be read and commented on since it correlates with many things of the insurgent activity as per Guerrilla Radio Man. The no-go zones are being formed in Mexico, first in Mexico proper, and soon at the new Aztlan, another sign of the collapse of the government de jure. In other words, they're gradually carving out no-go zones where the military can't even go in. Now, that's pretty wise. I mean, you know, they're drug cartels, but the point is strategy. You know, the Southern boys are always talking about seceding again. Well, this is a good chance for them to carve out no-go zones. If if a lot of those Southern guys that are always giving me hell for being such a Yankee lover would start carving out no-go zones, you know, places in Mississippi and places like that, where and the bayou down in Louisiana and like that.
Right.
To where nobody can go in there. I mean, it's not a part of the operation. And if they do, they end up dead. Well,
yeah, but,
you know, these are good staging areas, man. I mean, you know, especially if you can stay outside of airplanes, you know.
Now, I understand that, but, you know, we're talking about the Mexican military apparatus. If that was in the United States, I believe that the chief of staff and the secretary of state, along with the president, will be all for a all-out military strike against an all-white area that didn't want anyone going in that area. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but if our economy goes to crap like it's going to, then we'll be more like Mexico. And with the lack of resources, it's going to be a lot more difficult to fund those kind of operations. People forget it takes money to fund these military operations. If they don't have the
right.
money, if they don't have the money, they're going to have a problem. And if they don't have
and if
the cities start going up with the help of our black friends and maybe even Mexican friends, then the chances of carving out no-go zones in a lot of the backcountry are pretty good. The only problem you've got is with aircraft and satellites, you know.
Right.
So anyhow, I'm very optimistic about the tactics that are developing all over the world, not only in the Middle East, but here in Mexico. And I'm not making judgment on, you know, their drug cartels. I'm talking about just plain tactics. So anyhow, I think there's a lot of potential here.
Well, I think, you know, maybe in one aspect that depresses me a little bit that I don't hear about white Aryans doing anything like that. But then again, maybe it's good that I don't hear about that. Maybe because they're more low-key than the Mexicans, you know?
Well, a lot of people, there's a lot of whites out there that have developed those kinds of zones, but they're not, it is not in a hot battle or any, there's no firefighting going on. They're just a bunch of people out there in the backcountry that know the situation, and they're keeping their heads down, and when things get, you know, more rougher, well, then there'll be no-go zones. You know?
Right, and I think you're right. I think things are definitely going to get worse in 2009, and I think 2010. I mean, it's just going to get gradually worse, and I keep stressing for our listeners out there, you know, to be the best soldiers we can. Become students of war. I mean, get yourself in the best physical shape. Learn all you can about firearms, about technology, about computers, about all weapons, fighting with weapons, you know?
A good film along those lines is Southern Comfort. Did you ever see that film?
Oh, yeah, when they fired blanks at those Cajuns, and then the Cajuns went on a warpath against them.
Right. But the general story was quite good, because it showed how a disorganized backwoods bunch of Cajuns could take on a military outfit.
Right.
And even though they had been using blanks, don't ever send me into the damn swamp with blanks, I'll tell you that, because of snakes and crocodiles, man, I want live. I'd have had a pocket full of live ammo if I would have National Guardsman, no matter what.
Yeah, I guess they were on a training exercise, and I guess they got disorientated from the rest of their unit, and they came upon the Cajuns, and then they thought they'd play a joke by firing at them, and then the Cajuns thought they were being really shot at.
Yeah, and as I recall, none of them got out alive, even at the end, where a couple of them got into the village of Cajuns, and they sort of were friendly to them and accepted them a little bit, and then they killed them.
Right.
So the Cajuns are down there, man. I've been back in the Louisiana in the bayou with those Cajuns. I know how they are. A lot of them are Klansmen, you know.
Hey, you know, I was stationed down in Louisiana, Fort Polk, Louisiana. I was down there for 3 years. And I came across a term, and everyone who used this term was white. And, you know, you have the term Cajun. But they have a term down there, and they used it to describe themselves. And like I said, every one of these persons was white. A lot of white people down there call themselves coon ass. What does that mean?
I've heard that term, but I'm not that familiar with it. But, of course, Cajuns are originally the French who came down from Canada.
Right.
And immigrated down into that area. And then, of course, there is a mixture, and I forget the name of that, but the mixture of whites and Indians, too. Creole, mm-hmm. Creoles, I guess, like that. And there's some of those mixed in, I think, with the Cajuns, but most of the Cajuns that have kept their bloodline straight are white, and they're hell on wheels as far as being fighters. There's a hell of a lot of places down there in the backcountry. Even being a Yankee, I wouldn't want to be going in there unless they knew who I was and what I really stood for.
Right.
I mean, see your license plates like you come into some of those places from California, and you're taking your life in your hands. And in a way, that's good.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe I hung out at the military base too much. I really didn't venture out that much. I did a little bit. But I didn't meet a lot. You know, I tell you what, I was stationed with a guy down there who was from Louisiana, and I watched him with my own two eyes walk up to a rattlesnake and snatch it, cut the head off, and then prepared it to be cooked. It was amazing. I couldn't believe how he, it's not like he snuck up on the rattlesnake. He faced it head on. The rattlesnake coiled up. He did some maneuver with his hand, just snatched it up by its head. Amazing.
I went out there to a cross lighting one time when I still was with David Duke, way out in the bayou, and no, it's dark as hell. It's just a little farm surrounded by swamp, and I'm telling you, it's something else. A guy whose name was Frenchy that was had the property, but there was a situation where the cop detective followed us all out there from New Orleans, and he started stumbling through the swamp, and he was a black guy too, and we had guys all around the swamp armed to the teeth, you know, security, and all of a sudden the shooting started, and then the shooting stopped, and then the police from New Orleans, the chief of police, came running out there and said, don't shoot, we'll get him, and they got him out of there. They really saved that black guy's life, because if he'd ever really come upon our guys out there, he'd have been Swiss cheese, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's places out there that, you know, unless you're a cop that's part of the group or friendly cop, you ain't going to go. Now, you saw what happened in the Katrina flood, didn't you, where the white guys on the other side of the bridge, that's the other side over there where, out in there is where I went. I forget the name of that area there, but they were armed to the teeth, and they were shooting. There's a big documentary just been on TV where they were shooting these black people, and they had a regular vigilante deal set up to keep the blacks from coming out there. So that, you know, in a breakdown, that, you know, the race thing is right out there, boom, boom, boom. I mean, you know, it's, oh well, there's no racism anymore. Well, you have an emergency problem come around, and you'll see how fast racism comes to the fore.
Listen, if Yugoslavia can break up into like some of the most bloodiest warfare in this century, and basically a Croat and a Muslim from Bosnia Herzegovina and a Serb, you know, a lot of times they're indistinguishable racially. I mean, you know, you don't know which one's which. If they can go like that, can you imagine what the race thing will be like in America when the shit hits the fan?
Well, the thing about America, the United States, is it shouldn't have been one nation. It's too big, too many different interests, too much different territory and like that. People not really identifying with each other, except this fake television identification with each other.
Basically what television's for.
Yeah, United States should have probably been at least four countries.
Right.
You know, Canada too, you know. And we never had a civil war and all that kind of stuff, you know. You white people over here, you do what you want to do, we'll do what we want to do, you know.
Hey, you know what? The only team sport that I really watch is hockey, because it's, you know, still very much dominated by whites. And they had a hockey game at Wrigley Field the other day. It's called the Winter Classic, and I guess they do this every January 1st. Well, it's a neutral. And, you know, it's the Blackhawks against the Detroit Red Wings. And even though these were two American teams playing, they played the Canadian national anthem, because hockey was invented by the Canadians, and most players are Canadian. And I really listened to the words of the Canadian national anthem, and that's a beautiful national anthem. And then I heard ours, and I'm very familiar with ours, but my question is this: are we the only country on earth with a national anthem revolving around a war?
Well, some people have mentioned that, how they want to take, I guess it was Obama's wife, wanted to take bombs bursting in air out of our national anthem. Yeah, it is a little strange. It is a little strange. But however, the country was born in revolution and in armed conflict, so it seems like it's pretty apropos, even though the song's too damn hard to sing.
Right.
What's funny is to hear these niggers try to sing it. They all do that special nigger way. They want to go way up high. All that bullshit.
Right, when they get solely.
Oh, Christ. It drives me crazy.
I know. I hate that.
Well, anyhow, I don't salute that song or the flag or anything else anymore. Strictly a skull and crossbones boy.
There you go, Jolly Roger.
I don't care. I mean, the Southern guys, you can take that Confederate flag and dump it too, because that represented the Southern aristocracy and the planters that brought the invasion of the niggers to this continent. And if they had never done that and brought them in for cheap labor, just like they bring cheap Mexican labor in today, we wouldn't be in the shape we're in. So
right.
Some of these Southern guys get pissed off at me, but I said, look, let's go back to how it all started. Cheap labor and slavery by, rich bastards,
That's right.
They email me, get all over me. I said, they yell about the Yankees, but there was hardly any niggers in the North compared to the South. I mean, and even up into Tennessee where you had small farmers and stuff, they didn't have slaves. I mean, there might have been a few rich guys around that had slaves, but in fact, they, a lot of them didn't see much use of going to war in the Civil War because they said, "Well, what do we got to gain? We don't have slaves,
Right.
Anyhow,
I think that we need to just move on. We need to dump the swastika. I mean, that flag. I mean, not out of disrespect. I think it's a beautiful symbol, but we have our own time. We need to chart our own path. We are not Germany in the 1930s, and we are not Southerners of the early 19th century.
That's right. That's right. We, in fact, this is the first century that a world war will be fought one way or another strictly on the white race survival. Before this, it's not been that. I mean, there's been some of it. There's been, we're proper white. We've had laws to separate the race and stuff. But this time, it's a war for total survival, and we got it. This is a whole new era. It's pan-Aryanism.
Right.
And it's got to be every white swinging mother everywhere in the world, no matter where they're at, is in this war for survival. And we can't have any kind of regional flags and all that kind of crap,
That's right.
It's got to be one thing. People can figure out what they want, but I still think the skull and crossbones fits it probably better than most things,
Yeah.
We're privateers, man. We're like white Somalians.
There you go.
Grabbing those big ships and getting $20 million for getting them. I respect those guys,
Yeah, we are the pariahs of this society, so we might as well accept our role and do what we can to make sure that war for racial survival happens.
Absolutely, and if we're out in the open, like a lot of us are, we have to just accept the fact we're going to be pariahs. I'm getting every once in a while more people giving me a bunch of shit, and I have to, and I just laugh at them and say, "Well, you're a racist." I say, "Well, thank you for the compliment. I sure as hell am, and I'm not out to make any of them happy."
That's right.
They can kiss my white ass.
I want to be a piece of sandpaper on the ass of society.
Right. They can take their Republican Party and Democrat Party and all that bullshit and jump in the ocean as far as I'm concerned. And I don't care what they call me anymore,
Yeah.
As long as they call me for dinner.
Hey, let me talk about a show here I saw. They had a marathon the other day, I guess because of the holidays and stuff. But the show was called Burn Notice. And I don't know the name of the actors. This actor who plays the lead role, he's been in a number of movies. Usually plays an asshole, but I guess he plays a good guy in this one. And he's a CIA agent who's been betrayed by someone. So that means he's stuck in Miami. He has no bank accounts. He has no nothing. And he's somewhat on the run because, they want to liquidate him.
Yeah.
And, each episode he runs into someone with his crew that's helping him out, and they help out other people. And there were some interesting tactics in this, and I was really surprised to see this. For one, they were trying to get this guy. They wanted to get this diamond from this guy. And they wanted to make sure, they wanted to make it so he's paranoid of his own security staff. So he had one of his guys go up to one of his security personnel, say, hey, your name's Ed? Hey, Ed, it doesn't matter what my name is, but here's $1,000. There's more where that came from. You just kind of look the other way. When this goes on, we heard from someone else on the security staff that you're good to go, that you can be trusted, and we'll be in touch. And then two things can happen. If he goes to his boss, the boss could become even more paranoid and more mistrusting of his security. And if he tries to be secure everywhere, he's secure nowhere, as a principle of guerrilla warfare. Now, if he keeps the money and doesn't say nothing to his boss, and they're observing the security detail and everything's pretty much status quo, then maybe they can use that guy. So it's a win-win situation. Another thing they did, he wanted to make contact, this Burn Notice guy, he wanted to make contact with somebody, but he didn't know if he could trust them. So he said, hey, meet me on this bridge on Vincennes Boulevard or whatever in Miami. And he's there at the specified time, but he's watching the guy he's supposed to meet. The burned CIA agent is watching the guy he's supposed to meet with binoculars. And he calls the police on the guy. And he says, hey, there's a suspicious guy wearing a such-and-such suit. He's got a gun. And just place an anonymous call to 911. Then the police show up. The guy, the burned CIA agent, wants to watch the guy, how he reacts to that. If he's someone of the criminal element, he's going to haul ass, he's going to run, this and that. If he's an undercover agent, he's probably going to flash a badge. So he called the police on the guy to watch how he would react to that. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, so check this show out. It's called Burn Notice, and I think it's on either USA or TBS, or one of those stations. The new season starts sometime in January.
Burn, what was it? Burn what?
Burn Notice.
Notice, okay.
That's when they let you know, hey, you're no longer an agent, and we're going to come get you.
Well,
interesting, huh?
Yeah. Well, any of those agents want to come over to our side, they're welcome.
That's right. You don't got to go to no meetings or get a tattoo. You can just, support us with information anonymously.
Incidentally, I've got a notice here, and where is it? Maybe it's covered up here someplace. Well, I guess I don't have it here. But anyhow, the FBI is hiring 480 new agents. They're looking for a few good men. So there you go, boys. If you don't have a bunch of racial tattoos, you haven't been hanging around any of these racial organizations and stuff, and you're undercover lone wolf type, hey, apply. They pay pretty good,
That's right. You learn some good stuff. You could tip us off to what's coming. I mean, you would be invaluable. You would be beyond value for the service of our race.
And even if you failed to get in on the first try, at least you'd find out what they use and how they call you out. In other words, then the next guy came along could figure out countermeasures on that,
So, right.
I mean, they're going to give you a lie detector test probably and all that kind of stuff. But the point is a lot of people, a lot of young people, sharp people, out of work and so forth, well, just call the FBI and say, I want to be an agent, boy.
Yeah, I mean, get in it, not just an agent, get in any type of law enforcement. You would be so valuable to the cause.
Sure. And a lot of people think we're totally anti-cop, but we're not. We're anti-bad cops. in other words.
Right.
I have no problem with peace officers, you know, in a community that they just roll when there's something life-threatening and things like that. But they're not got their nose into every part of your life. And you know, your politics is your business and stuff like that. But most cops, because of the people who sign their check, they're being told exactly what to do by these traitorous bastards in higher positions in the police department, and then that makes them sort of an enemy of the people, if you know what I mean?
Right.
So, but as far as cops that are white cops that are true to their race and keep their mouth shut and try to be as good to white people if they deserve it as they can, we have no problem with those people.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, let me tell you, I had a little incident the other night. You know, I don't mind telling people I'm from Berwyn, Illinois, which is a just pretty much right outside of Chicago, borders Cicero on the west. And Berwyn on the western border, there's a town that borders us, is called Riverside, Illinois. And I was walking through Riverside, Illinois the other night, and Riverside, Illinois is still like 90% white. And I think that there's like an unwritten law that they want to keep it that way. Because I was walking through the neighborhood, just going on my nightly walk. I said, you know what, instead of walking through Berwyn, let me walk through Riverside. Now, I'm dressed completely in black. Black gloves, black hoodie, black pants, black boots, black socks, black hat, and I had my hood up over my head. And a Riverside cop rolls by, and he kind of stops and does a U and comes up on me, and he gets out of the car, and he's saying, what are you doing around here? And I had my line all prepared. I said, you know, I got rheumatoid arthritis, and the only form of exercise I can get is walking. And I didn't even get the sentence out of my mouth, and the cop says, oh, you're okay. Go about your business. And he gets back in his thing. He saw this black figure, like, oh, maybe black or Hispanic, but when he came up face to face with me, saw I was white, he said, oh, you're okay, go about your business.
Yeah.
And I'm dressed completely in black, Tommy.
Yeah. Well, there's cops like that out there, you know. There's cops like that out there. Well, I'll tell you what, I told you before, Berwyn strikes a chord in my heart, because when my mother and father were married, and I forget whether I'd been born yet or I'd just been born. They lived in a house trailer in Berwyn, Illinois.
And
my father worked up there in Chicago. He was an engineer. But that trailer burned down, so Berwyn was bad luck for them. They got out of there. Yeah.
Too bad. You guys could have helped kept it white. I mean, we've almost completely lost this town.
That caused my mother major trauma. She was just deathly afraid of fire after that
right.
First place she lived in there burned down. So anyhow,
you know, I was thinking about something yesterday. You know, a lot of times you hear when these muds come over to the western nations, oh, they're looking for a better life, or they just, you know, they just want to support their families, help them. They want to feed their families. You hear these sob stories. Well, right now in the world, the number one economy in the world is China. And you don't see poor Eastern Europeans moving to China and taking up Chinese jobs. So I don't even want to hear that excuse no more.
Well,
they need to get out of Western land.
Well, you know, of course they want a better life. I mean, so does a cockroach, you know.
Right.
They want a better life. Well, what that means to them, though, is what is different than what meant to our forefathers. What it means to them is when they see all these millionaires on TV and these soap operas, and everybody's wearing evening clothes and drinking cocktails in the middle of the afternoon, and nobody's ever working. That's what is exported all over the world. That's the propaganda. You know, come to America and you'll be rich, and you can, you know, if you're non-white, you can be screwing white women and live in a lap of luxury, you know.
Right.
So that's their idea of they're wanting a better life. Yeah, they want your life. They want your job. They want your house. They want your land. And if they don't get it, they'll go back home. In fact, right now, I'm getting reports from all over the country that due to the economy downturn, there's a hell of a lot of Mexicans now going on back to Mexico.
Not enough of them.
Well, of course not enough of them, but at least... One thing they've got going down there, no matter how far it goes down, the government supplies them with food. frijoles and beans and things like that, to where they can survive no matter what, you know?
Right.
But here, they just die, I guess, in the street.
Hey, how much time is left? I want to see if I have time to talk about something here.
You got a lot of time. Just go ahead.
All right. Now, there was an episode on the other day, and I can tell you before, if I'm going to watch TV, I'm not going to watch no stupid shit like Dude, Where's My Car, or Varsity Blues, or some shit like that. I want to learn something. So there was a show on TLC the other day. It's called Extreme Forensics. And it was about this guy, the black guy, actually, but, you know, this isn't indicative of black people. What I'm about to describe, white guys have done this, too. But this black guy, he was like a principal of a school, of a grammar school in California. He goes back east to visit his family. He went to, I believe it was like Columbus, Ohio, right? Now, he's got a plane fare going to Columbus, Ohio. He has credit card receipts showing that he was in Columbus, Ohio, at specific dates at a specific store. Now, when that was happening, when he was supposedly at this store, his family was murdered in California. His wife and his three children, shot in the head, execution style, all of them. And he gets back to California, and like, oh my God, my family's been murdered. Well, you know, the police found the bodies before he got back. But, you know, he comes back, so I couldn't have done it. I was in California. But they know, you know, because of the track record, the reports from family and friends that, hey, these two aren't getting along. They always look close to a victim for the potential murder. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay, so they said, well, we got to find out what's up with this guy. So they said, well, what'd you do when you got to Columbus? Well, you know, I had a lot of place to go, people to see, so I rented a car. So they found out where he rented a car, and they said, and then let me see those receipts. So you was at, for example, you was at Walmart on June 6th, approximately 12:36, according to your receipt here. So they would go to the Walmart. They say, hey, let me see your security film from June 6th at 12:36 in the afternoon. So they would pull it up, and they didn't find the guy anywhere on the store surveillance, but they saw his brother. So they said, all right, his brother is using his credit card, racking up these receipts. It's kind of like a false alibi. And they said, well, let me see the car that you rented. So they went to the car rental place, and they said, we want to look at this car. And they look at the mileage. Wow, for a new car, it's got a lot of mileage on this car. Then they track down all the people, because it was a relatively new rental car. And this person who's under suspicion was like the sixth person to have rented this car. So they track down the previous five renters and find out where they went. And, everything proved to be correct, that they were where they said they were and this and that. So all the this huge amount of mileage on the odometer was obviously put on by him, because it wasn't put on by the other people, because they didn't travel the far distances. So this guy, this murderer, is saying that, well, there's no way I could have drove from Ohio straight on through to Bakersfield, California, murder my family, then drive back. You know, and that'd be, if driving straight through, that'd be easily a two-day trip. Okay, so
right. They
found the car, and they took the car apart. And they, the trace evidence technicians, guys, they looked at the bugs, the insects in the radiator, because when you're driving down a road 60 miles an hour, you're going to run it. Some insects are going to impact on your car, and in some respects, there may not be too much left of them. So they got a.
Is that what they call planting a bug?
No, I don't know. Let me finish this. All right, but they tracked down this entomologist. Okay.
Yeah.
And they took the car apart, and they found species of insects that are only indigenous west of the Rocky Mountains. Now, they know the history of this car because they talked to the rental people. They know where the car has been. The car is from Columbus, Ohio. They tracked down the first five renters. They stayed in the Ohio area, but in the radiator of the car, they had insects that were indigenous to the western part of the United States. So the guy was busted, and he went on trial for murdering his wife and his three kids, and he's in jail now for it.
Question.
So,
question. how would you have circumvented that problem in his story? I mean, what could he have done that would have eliminated that problem?
First of all, I mean, because he's the husband, he's already going to be suspect number one.
Right.
If this was a guy who did a random killing, I don't think they would. In order for them to get all this, you have to have the person of interest. And if this was like a random killing, there's no way that they would have been able to track down a rental car. I mean, it's just too much.
Most murders are done by people who know somebody. They know each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And cops like those kind of murders because they can solve them.
Oh, surely.
The type of murders that cops hate are random killings.
Why do you think the mob on the East Coast used to send torpedoes out to California to knock somebody off that nobody knew and they didn't live out there and they got right back on the plane and went back east?
Right. They're always out-of-town shooters.
Yeah.
And, right.
Yeah. And was there an end to this story?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, if you're going to rent a car to do any kind of activity, first of all, I assume that all of us out there are doing random stuff, whatever that means, whatever your mental constitution can afford you to do. I don't think that we would come under the type of scrutiny that this guy did because he was in such a close relation to the victims. You know what I mean?
Well, why didn't he pay some trucker $100 to ride along with him, hitchhike?
See, that's another thing, too. We need to befriend the truckers. Most of your truckers are good old white boys, you know, rednecks or Yankees or whatever. A lot of them are just... We need to befriend truckers, man. We can get from one part of the country to the other without leaving a paper trail.
Yeah, we got a lot of friends.
My point of this is this.
Yeah, what is your point?
Even if you try to create a paper trail to say you were someplace else, it can be used against you. These credit card receipts actually hurt him in the long run because they went to that store and saw that he was nowhere in the store by reviewing the surveillance videos. They saw his brother there, so the gig was up from then on.
Well, the guy then calls Tom Metzger and says, "What do I do?" And I say, "I have nothing to say." You don't say reply to anything. It's still very hard for them to build a case beyond reasonable doubt if you say nothing. You don't come up with an alibi. You don't do anything. No matter how bad it looks, don't say anything. You still got a chance before the jury if you look pretty decent and speak well and like that and maybe not even get on the stand. That they got to have reasonable deal to convict you. So this guy talked quite a bit, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He said, "No, I didn't do it, this and that." But here's the thing. If he murdered his wife and kids and he said, "Well, I have nothing to say," wouldn't that make him look guilty already?
It don't make any difference what it makes him look like. It's what the jury thinks. They can't introduce evidence if you don't give it to them. And I know that's the fallacy. A lot of people say, "Well, if I don't talk to them, it'll make me look guilty." Well, that's the fallacy. Because it don't work that way. If you don't give them any evidence, it don't make any difference whether the cop thinks you're guilty or not. He's got to prove it. And if you don't help him prove it, he's not going to prove it. I've known guys who emailed me before and said, "Hell, thank you, Tom. I've beat two or three different things because of your advice with five words."
But I think your advice applies really to us. I mean... because if I'm a guy, right, and my wife and kids are murdered, and the cop says, "Hey, you want to come down to the station and talk to us about what happened?" If I say, in that specific scenario, a guy murders his family, and he says, "Well, I have nothing to say," instantly red flags going to go up. But as far as our thing goes, in our group, lone wolf activity. Absolutely, I have nothing to say.
No, I don't agree.
Mark Emil,
I disagree. I think it should be that anyway, because
really?
Either that or just call my attorney, and that usually they'll back off, and you'll be a person of interest. But your attorney will tell you not to talk. What the hell do you think you're paying these guys $200 an hour for? They're going to tell you don't talk, and so just tell the cops speak to my attorney. The attorney says he's not going to talk because the attorney knows that when you talk about anything, you're digging a hole. So I don't care what kind of thing it is. I have nothing to say, and you can't hurt yourself that way. You don't care if every cop in town or every person in town thinks you're guilty. They've got to prove it in a court of law.
Yes, well, I'm glad you cleared that up.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, back to our agents. Here's that thing I found. 850 new FBI agents. Despite a bleak economic environment featuring wide-ranging layoffs and rising unemployment, the nation's premier law enforcement agency is touting one of the largest hiring blitzes in 100-year history. The FBI is about to embark on its biggest hiring spree since immediately after September 11, 2001. The FBI postings opening for 850 special agents and more than 2,100 professional support personnel. Now, that's a good spot to get into, too, support personnel. Mm. Officials say it's the largest FBI job posting since immediately after September 11th. The FBI's unexpectedly large number of job openings results more from attrition and a wave of retirements than from growing government appropriations, Bureau's officials told CNN. So all the old boys are getting out. I would recommend if you're a young guy out there, a young white guy, and you got your intelligent guy, and you've got some education, at least a BA or something like that, go on down there and sign up. But for I think don't have any connection with any of us, and don't go to any meetings or any join anything. Then you can get in there.
Now, as far as them communicating information to us, they would have to use a sterile computer to send that kind of stuff out.
Well,
like a pseudonym email ad. What the hell is that?
Somebody.
Oh.
Jerking me off. Anyhow,
what do you think about that?
Well, I say they shouldn't have any contact at all, because it may be for years. I mean, these guys are going to be moles. And,
right.
A lot of times we might think there's something important they should tell us. It's not that important. Hold on here. Yeah,
okay.
These guys are deep moles, they got to be. You know, look, all you have to do is take the apparatus and strategy of the Communist Party worldwide and the KGB and all that kind of stuff and just use the tactics. The tactics are all there. I mean,
right.
The Germans were terrible at intelligence, believe me. The French and the English were great, and the Russians were pretty good, too. But all you have to do is take their cell structure, take their deep cover, their mole situation, and use it for us. And some of these right-wingers say, well, you're acting like a communist. Well, screw you, buddy. We're out to win. You know?
Right.
And so I wouldn't want any kind of contact maybe for years from one of these guys, you know? Because they can be doing things that they don't even need to tell me about, you know?
Right.
They should be ideologically in a position to know what to do anyhow. I mean, do you have to call me every time you want to do something? Hell no. You know what to do.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, well, that's about it for today. And you want to do your lecture here, too, so we'll be doing that and get that on the air. And remember, all you people up there that want to get the Guerrilla Radio Man, you're going to have to join the radio club and contribute a little money there, because Guerrilla Radio Man spends a lot of time and money learning things that you need to know, and the organization, and not the organization, but the insurgency, needs some money, baby.
That's right.
Okay?
All right, 14.
14 and 5. Thank you. There you go with a very fine, the fine music of Wagner, the Rite of the Valkyries, the whole movement. How about that? This is January the 6th, 2009, Tuesday, and I now introduce you to Gorilla Radio Man for another one of his famous lectures.
This is Gorilla Radio calling. Werewolf Radio calling. White Pariah Radio calling. Aryan Proletariat Radio calling. Ghost Wolf Radio calling. You like that? That's called evolution. You know, no one could say that I plagiarized off a song from some social Marxist band. But I really like the concept of the Ghost Wolf, because if you look at all of your successful guerrilla movements around the world, whether it be Castro, whether it be the Viet Cong, they all have popular support. If a Mexican or a mestizo insurgency formed in the Southwest, which it will, they're in a perfect geographical spot because they will get tons of support probably from Mexico. You know, the drug cartels and the sales they get from their drugs or whatever, they'll probably supply the Aztlan Army of the Southwest with arms. And, you know, looking at the history of the white race, I'm sure there'll be white manufacturers of guns and weapons in Europe and around the world that will gladly sell to them just to make a buck. That's our history. White killing white. You know, the British and the French backing the Turks against the Russians in the Crimean War, which I just learned about. I didn't know who the participants were in the Crimean War. I knew the Russians were involved, but I didn't know that the British and the French backed the kinky-haired, shit-skinned Turks against our brothers, the Russians. So, if you're not evolving, you're stagnant. And if you're stagnant, you're going to die. And that's mainly most of the struggle. Most of the struggle, the white racial, white separatist struggle around the world, really, most of it is stagnant, while our enemy has been evolving over the last number of decades. We need to evolve, become proficient in information technology. The system will recruit the brightest minds graduating from MIT and other schools, other bastions of social Marxism, diploma factories. You know, but these are smart kids, but they're, you know, the government or the Zog or whoever is just throwing a bunch of money at them. So we need to learn as much as we can. We need to be low key. I've said this before, we need to fly under the radar. You know, I talked with Tom Metzger on the show we just did earlier about a show called Burn Notice. And I noticed that the characters in there, that they all had connections. You know, one of the lead guys of this show, one of his friends had a connection at the bank. And the connection at the bank told him the account number of someone that they were investigating, and what his schedule was, how many times he'd come to the bank, and who else is on the account or whatever. You know, as an open racist, we will never have access to information like that. We won't. And if you think I'm being cowardly about my racism, you are dead wrong. The fact that I put myself on the line to do these shows, the fact that ever since I started co-hosting with Tom Metzger, I've been interviewed by the FBI 3 times. I mean, you know, I don't see myself as a coward at all. I killed the cowardly self 9 years ago when I became racially aware, thanks to George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. That's what started it. But as an open racist, we will never make the contacts of people that work in the banks. You know, you want information on someone. You know, most people, most white people are, you know, classically conditioned to be repulsed by racism. They are fed that over and over again in the media. And just like Ivan Pavlov's dogs who salivated at the mere sound of the dinner bell, we are classically conditioned as well. We, you know, just because we're a smarter animal than the dog in most aspects, does not mean that we cannot be classically conditioned. It just takes more stimulus. And ever since Hollywood and the movies, and I remember an episode of, I think it was The Rifleman with Chuck Connors. And I remember that Sammy Davis Jr. played a bad guy, and he was a black gunslinger. And when he come into town, all the white people would scramble and run for cover. Come on, think of the imagery in that. You know, the Jews knew exactly what they were doing. So our institutions are gone. You have no allies anywhere. And the ghost wolf, what separated him from the gorilla, is that he has no popular support. We're going to go in there and say no, and that we will not have popular support. Because the white race has become so lackadaisical, apathetic, and cowardly, and distracted by Xbox and PlayStation and the NFL and all this other bullshit, if our actions result in collateral damage, we need to say, you know, it's a terrible shame, but it had to be done. I'm not someone who smiled when I saw the fireman holding a dead baby at the Oklahoma City bombing. But you know what? What Timothy McVeigh did, I'm sorry, I hate to say this, FBI boys, but maybe it needed to be done. You know, he's the prototype of what, actually, I hope to see more in the future. What are you saying, Frank Bauer? You want to see more innocent people die? No. I don't want to see any innocent people die. But you know what? If you want to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. So as an open racist, you miss out on potential contacts you can make in the military, in the police. I've gotten all kinds of information from the police. I've had conversations with police officers who didn't know I was a racist. And they know me. They train with me at the martial arts facility. You know, I knew this guy. I knew this cop at a certain suburb outside Chicago. I'm not going to say which one. And he knows me real well. We have a great relationship. We don't go out drinking beers together. We don't call each other on the phone, but every time we see each other, we're very cordial. You know, we ask what's going on in each other's life. And, you know, he tells me certain things. He tells me that, oh, you know, we're really patrolling this apartment complex because of gang activity and this and that. You know, if I'm an open neo-Nazi with a swastika on my forehead and boots, bombers, and braces, and you know what? If you're going to wear that in society, there is an element of bravery wearing that. But you know what? It's mental masturbation. You're not going to get anywhere with those tactics. You will miss out on potential contacts as an open racist. You know. I talked with Tom earlier about this technique I saw about calling the police on someone you make a contact with just to see how they react. That is a good technique. You know, we need to develop the art, perfect the art of misinformation, misinforming. Not with the police. We're not going to do that with law enforcement. Every time you interact with law enforcement or ZOG, you say, I have nothing to say, no matter what. Don't be like me 8 months ago, get baited into an argument in the doorway of my house. And I started out saying, I have nothing to say, I have nothing to say. And all of a sudden, this one guy who maybe read a few books on National Socialism or the white separatist movement started challenging my belief system. And that got under my craw, and I started blasting his ideology and his support of the system and law and order and all that other stuff. Bandenkrieg, a nice German word. The German language is very, very specific. You know, if you say, are you going to the store in German, in English, you don't know who I'm talking to, but in German, you know that I'm talking to either a male or a female because of the structure of their language. But Bandenkrieg, I believe the way the Germans say it, basically means gang war. While bands of men committing war. And the imagery is much more stronger in the German. Bandenkrieg. We need to put that in our lexicon. so. Misinformation. We need to learn about that. Once you can, read up on it. Google it. Go to dogpile.com, another search engine, and look up misinformation or the art of misinformation and see what books it'll lead you to or what essays have been written. You know, psyops. You know, in the 1950s, the U.S. government was broadcasting white noise over a so-called secure net. Do you know that the Russians spent millions and millions of rubles trying to decode it, trying to find out what was going on? First of all, they advertised or put misinformation out there that this is a secure network. And then when the Russians tapped onto it, they spent years and millions of rubles trying to decode it. The Russians aren't stupid. That doesn't make them dumbasses. By no means. They were in space before we were. You know, Yuri Gagarin, you know, he must have had balls the size of cantaloupes to go out into space, not knowing. I mean, he has no one else's experience to glean from. So, typical white men. Brave, adventurous, you know? And how do we channelize that natural instinct that's in the white race now? We have the X Games. We have people who want to base jump and bungee jump and, you know, do all kinds of dangerous stuff. But standing up for the race, oh, we can't do that. That is a prime example of classical conditioning in the white psyche. We're brave enough to jump out of an airplane at 13,000 feet and open up our chutes at 600 feet, which is high altitude, low opening, halo. You know, we're brave enough to do that, but oh, we can't stand up for the race. I don't want to be seen as a racist. That is a tall tale sign that our race is classically conditioned. So you need to see yourself, analyze who you are in the struggle. How can they get to you? If you're a drug addict, they got you. If you're an alcoholic, they got you. If you're a gambler, they got you. You know? I'm telling you, I've said this before. If I meet someone and he's like, wow, this guy's saying the right things. He's got this as a resource. He's got that. Oh, shit, he's got a gambling problem. I won't have nothing to do with it. You know what? I'll have something to do with him, all right, but I won't let him know I'm a racist. You know, if he's got access to information about people's banking accounts or this or that, I'll play on his weakness. I'll take him to the riverboat gambling casinos and, you know, befriend him through his weakness so I can glean information. But as an open racist, I probably won't make that contact. And you know what? I would probably keep this guy at an arm's distance. I would probably give him some kind of phone number to get a hold of me that's somehow not connected to me. Use your imagination. Whether it's a track phone or you know, pseudonym an email account. You know, I told you about how I do that. I have a couple of them, and each time I correspond with people, like I said before, I have an email address that I use to communicate with social Marxists, with enemies of our race. While I'm portraying an enemy of our race, I got an email pseudonym that has a female name to it, and I've told you why I use that. You'll have to listen to the other shows why I use that. And no, it's not for any freaky stuff. I'm a red-blooded heterosexual kind of guy. So, but the more you care, the more leverage they have. What is your weakness, and how can they get to you? You know, if you have a wife and kids, and you're very leery about losing them, which you should be, you know, maybe you should be an above-ground operator, and maybe you, if this fits you, you need to read up all you can about operating a safe house. Because I did read a book a couple of years ago about how to operate a safe house, and I think it was written by Jefferson Mack. How to operate a safe house. The subtitle was running a ring of or how to run a ring of spies or something like that. But the best safe houses are houses that are owned by people who have nothing to do, ostensibly nothing to do with the struggle. They've never went to a rally, you know. If you seize their hard drive, they're not going to find resist.com on it, because they're crafty enough to go to a public library where they can find information from the Insurgency Radio Network, which the Ghost Wolf radio show is a subsidiary of. You know, so they're going to find a library that doesn't make you check in. I have found that college libraries, I don't have to check in at the front desk and sign in to use a computer, because if you do something on that computer, communicate with someone, they could trace the IPO back to the library, and they'll come up to the clerk and they'll say, "Hey, librarian, we want to know who was on that computer right there on June 6th at 12:26, and they'll look up their records. Oh, it was Frank Bauer, you know. So I right now, I have at least six libraries at the top of my head. I know that I can go in, just use the library without punching in some kind of code that corresponds with my true identity. You know, you want to stay away from that also. I was using a library in the suburb of Chicago one time, and I could, it's like a free library card. I can be on there. I had a half-hour access to the internet, but I had to punch in a temporary number that corresponded with my identity. I would never use that to communicate with underground people. I have a pseudonym email address, and I only use it from a library that I don't have to sign in, or and especially a library that has no surveillance. But if you're going Ghost Wolf, Lone Wolf, Aryan Pariah, Insurgency kind of thing, no matter what you do in your Ghost Wolf activities, no matter what it is, you are dressing in nondescript clothes, uncharacteristic of who you are, acting in casual confidence. I was thinking about something yesterday. You know, we got in Chicago, we got this whole Roland Burris thing going on, you know, Blagojevich, punk ass, I never liked him, appointed this guy. You know, all of a sudden the race card's being pulled, and this Bobby Rush guy, who was a Black Panther in the 60s, who's now like an alderman of Chicago and Chicago city politics, and he's getting skinny, and he's all frail and weak, and I guess he's got some kind of disease. Hope the fucking guy dies, and I hope it's long and torturous. Another German phrase I want to turn you guys on to is Schadenfreude. That means taking pleasure in other people's misfortune. Bobby Rush, Schadenfreude. I will smile if I live to see the day that you die. I will smile, and I will hold my Monster Energy drink up to the sun and salute the sun. I need to stay away from that stuff. But he was talking the other day, and he's saying that the U.S. Senate is the last bastion of plantation racial politics in America, and that's why they want to keep it all white. Let me ask you something, Bobby Rush. When is the last time a senator has done anything that has benefited the white working class, that has benefited the survival of the white race and the United Snakes of sold-out America? When was the last time? We've been fucked by them for decades. They're looking out for the interests of the rich, not the white people, you sorry nigger fuck. I'm trying to stop cursing. Sorry about that. So, the more you care, the more leverage they have. Where can they get to you? You know what? Sometimes we need to just say, when faced with an enemy so overpowering and overwhelming, so powerful and overwhelming as the Zog is, when faced with an enemy like that, when no tactical advantage seems possible, maybe the best course of action is to make sure that no one wins. Right? Scorched earth. I mean, you should be involved in activism that sows the seeds of chaos. You know, we've tried the law and order thing, and the system has told us you're not going to get any change that way. And we as Ghost Wolves, you guys as Ghost Wolves, I can't be a Ghost Wolf because the mere fact I'm doing this show disqualifies me from that title. But you Ghost Wolves out there, you nameless faceless, shadowy figures of white racism. You don't have a swastika on your armband, you have it in your heart. And you guys, you know, making contacts with people in various stratas of society and all institutions, and they're glad to make friends with you because you seem like you're a tolerant guy. We're sold out everywhere. We have no friends anywhere. So when faced with an enemy that's so overwhelming and so encompassing, like Tom said before, we are soldiers parachuted behind enemy lines. No one is our friend until they prove it with the deeds of their hands. You cannot make friends with anyone just because they say something. I told you before when I did a show with Tom Metzger one time, I had a guy knock on my door looking for directions. Looking for a direction how to get somewhere. I don't remember where, because what stood out in my mind with that conversation with this guy was, man, what happened to this area? We got all these niggers and spicks around here. Here's this guy, comes out of the blue, you know, requesting some kind of assistance from me, and pulls the race card. That instantly sent a red flag up in my mind, and I played along with it. I didn't use no racial epithets in return. I'm like, yeah, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, the whole country's going that way. But yeah, you want to find such and such, just go continue east on 26th Street and take that into Cicero and make a right at whatever, you know. So, I went in my house, went out my back door, hauled ass up the alley that parallels the street I live on, come up another couple of streets, paralleling the movement of this guy because he was continuing in a westerly direction, even though the directions I gave him were east. Then I headed him off at a corner where I knew I could observe him from all directions and any traffic coming from any directions. You got to know the terrain in your area. You got to think tactically. That's why I tell you guys, you don't need to read Mein Kampf anymore. You don't need to read This Time the World anymore. You know what the problem is. All you got to do is listen to Tom's radio shows, and you can get an education. You can get a bachelor's degree in the racial eclectics, you know, learn about the transnational corporations. But I paralleled this guy's movement, and I saw him meet with some well-dressed guys that were sitting in a sedan. They talked to him a little bit outside the car, then all three of them got in the car. What do you think that was about? So don't just buddy up to anyone who used the nigger word. Buddy up to someone who you've seen personally do something with the works of their hands that says, all right, this guy cannot be agent provocateur. He cannot be, well, watch out for agent provocateurs. I'm talking, this guy's got to do something dastardly to earn your trust. If he don't do nothing dastardly, hey, you're just another Joe Schmedlap in the flow of catalyzed Americans going through the motions of modern American society. You're just another guy, tolerant, nigger lover. You like the Mexicans, you know, doing jobs that white people supposedly don't want to do. Shit, there are white people doing shitty jobs in this country for hundreds of years. Don't tell me white people don't want to get dirty. But when faced with an overwhelming enemy, maybe the only tactic you have is to make sure that no one wins. Reminds me of the time I played Risk for the first time a couple years ago. You know the game Risk, where you try to dominate the world by moving pieces around a board game that looks like the face of a globe, has all the planets, has all the, you know, continents on it. And I've never played this game before. So, you know, I got my troops amassed in Eastern Europe, and I'm trying to take over the Ukraine and Belarus and all and Russia, and I want to establish a fascist regime in that area and maybe just spread out from there. You know, I mean, that's what's going through my mind. I'm having fun. You know, we're all having fun. There's like five of us playing the game. And I started losing. You know, I started losing troops in South America, and I started losing troops in Western Europe. I'm trying to consolidate my force in Eastern Europe and then just take all of Europe in one fell swoop. I started losing. So the only thing I can do is make sure no one wins. I started, you know, just using, sacrificing my guys in South America, North America, and sacrificing my guys in Eastern and Western Europe and Asia, eating up their other pieces. When the game was over, I had completely lost all my guys, but everyone else's forces were so spread out that they couldn't consolidate nothing. Nobody wins. And it's the first time I've played that game. And everyone else has played it multiple times, and they were pissed off at me. I mean, I'm not saying they were ready to go to blows, but they were pissed off, talking shit the rest of the night. What kind of shit was that, man? You know, you saw it, you were losing, you know, you should bow out gracefully. No, don't ever bow out gracefully. If you can't win, no one wins. And if that is not part of your ideology by now, then don't go to resist.com no more. You know who the true prophets are in a movement. It's the pariahs of the movement. David Duke can have a fucking fundraiser, $75 a head. Maybe a couple hundred people, are sign up for it and they have to pay in advance. And some of these people have so much money, well, something else came up, so they just write the $75 off as a loss. They never showed up. But David Duke still got paid. He's not doing nothing for the race. I've heard many interviews with him. He acts cowardly, intolerant. Well, we're just looking out for white civil rights. Fuck you. The people affiliated with Resist.com, Lone Wolf Wall Street, Lone Wolf Southern California, Lone Wolf Computer Man, and everyone else who contributes behind the scenes who don't come on the radio shows, we're the pariahs of the struggle. And we're fucking paupers, man. Gotta beg and we don't plead for people to financially support us? What the fuck is that? Do you believe in the survival of the white race or not? Back your fucking words up with action. You know, fucking throw Tom Metzger a sawbuck, you know? He went through all this hard work of creating these DVDs that you guys can borrow and keep as long as you want. Throw him a fucking hondo. You know, don't drink a case of beer for a month. Save up that money and throw him a hondo. Throw him a sawbuck. It's bullshit. But I made sure that no one won that game. Scorched earth. And it was what was real telling me about all of that was that the psyche of everyone else, you know, you gotta lose. If you lose, you lose. There's nothing you can do. Bullshit. If you can lose, there's something you can do. I love Russian history. And I hate to use an example from fratricidal war, but when the Napoleon troops are coming in on Moscow, they're marching along and they're talking with one another. Man, I can't wait to get to Moscow. Take a bath, get some food, maybe meet a little Russianite, little girl, you know, a Russianite woman, you know. I don't want you guys getting any pedophile thing, you know, out of that. I believe in death to all pedophiles. Hammer and blowtorch taken to their bodies. But anyways, so these French troops are marching along and they're saying, man, the horizon looks pretty lit up. Wonder what's going on there. A couple hours later, they crest the hill. Moscow's in flames. The Russian people left. Well, most of them, like 99% of the Russian people, vacated the city and fucking burned it. Burned all the food stores and everything. I mean, the French soldiers were demoralized. I mean, the few Russians that they found left in the city, they executed right on the spot. They were unarmed. They came up to them, mercy, mercy, you know, and a French soldiers shot them on the spot. Most people cannot handle scorched earth. Listen, we're losing this thing here. We've lost North America. We closed the borders today. There's still enough non-whites to just wreak havoc. So, scorched earth. You know, I was watching 60 Minutes on Sunday, and I don't know if any of you guys caught that episode, but they got technology now using the use of an MRI to scan brain waves. And they think that this technique is so revolutionary, they think that within 5 to 10 years, they can literally read people's minds. And this is how it works. They scanned all these people's brains. They would flash an image of them on the screen like a hammer. and they would see what triggers in the brain and how it's formed. Because when you think of a hammer, you don't even think of the tool. You think of how it's used, how it's held in hand. All that information is stored in the brain. And they watch the brain fire up in a certain way, you know, to show that they were thinking about a hammer. Then they tested them. Then they showed them pictures of something, and the people being tested didn't say what they were, but the people running the apparatus said, oh, you were thinking of hammer. Oh, my God, you were correct. You know, this is scary shit. George Orwell, this is beyond George Orwell, you know. And the guy who they're interviewing, I don't know if he was a Jew or not. I'm waiting for him to flash his name, but he was all fired up about it. When in this Leslie Ann Stahl, she's like, you know, what's this going to do for privacy? And, you know, and he just, like, shucked off the question with a big smile on his face. Well, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, didn't say shit, but he don't care. He's getting dollar signs. He knows that the defense contractors are just going to just make him rich. And now that they got this apparatus now where they can shoot a laser at your forehead. They're developing this now in conjunction with this MRI thing. Shoot a laser at your forehead, and they believe they can develop that, well, over the next 10 years where they can not only read your mind, but actually predict intent. You know? If you're thinking about a gun, well, your brain waves will look a certain way when you're thinking about a gun, and then they'll draw other correlations with intent, and they're just making, man, you know what, I'm all for science, and I wouldn't mind this science if the people behind it were people of our mindset. I wouldn't mind. You know, if that makes me a hypocrite, I don't care. I mean, you know, I mean, I believe in freedom of speech in one way, but if I was running an Aryan society, and I had a few remnants of black, brown, and yellow in my society, I wouldn't give them freedom of choice. In the most merciful ways, I would treat them. I would sterilize them and use them for, you know, digging sewers and trenches or whatever. That'd be the most humane thing I would do. Let's talk about, I still haven't finished this thing I want to do about manhunters. You know, this guy, he was in the country illegally, and U.S. Marshals cornered his wife and said, where's this guy at? When you're going to meet him? What's going on? And she said, well, I'm going to meet him at this restaurant at such and such corner. And I'm thinking that maybe she had arranged with this guy that if I don't show up at such and such place, something's gone wrong. Well, you know what? Do this, white insurgents. You know, you already got a cell structure. One of your guys has to go somewhere to get some kind of information or get some kind of resource to help you in your activity. You're not just gonna have your comrade just meet you at the safe house or whatever. You always gotta anticipate someone being burned, someone being flipped. Okay? So say, hey, meet me at this restaurant at such and such time. Now I'm gonna observe you standing on that street corner waiting for me a couple blocks away. I'm going to look at you from a covert position. I'm going to look at you with binos. And I want you to give me some signals to tell me that the feds, or not the feds, but Zog is watching you. They've interviewed you. They forced you to burn me. I want you to have a signals arranged that are, you don't want to look like a third base coach. You don't want to make your signals obvious, take your hat off and run your fingers through your hair. I thought one of the best signals to use is look at your watch, maybe two times, glance around like you're impatient, like, where the fuck is this guy? Get your hands on your hips. Use something that corresponds with natural human behavior as a signal. Don't have your guy stand on the corner leaning his hand up against the wall, tapping on the wall. And they're, you know, you have a sequence of three taps into it. Don't do stuff like that. Okay, that will be picked out easily. Okay, so have your signal set up where it naturally flows with human behavior. Like, you know, you're looking at your watch, got your hips on your hands, you kind of throw up your hands a little bit. So where the fuck is this guy? You know, something like that. And that you'll have your signals like, hey, right now I'm under Zog surveillance, don't come near me. Or you can have it arranged, hey, coast is clear, you know. And if they give a coast is clear signal and you show up, And all of a sudden you hear, drop the weapon, show me your hands, get on the fucking ground. When the minute you hear that and you've been sold out, you kill that guy. Kill him immediately. That's how we got to get. You know, I don't know if I have enough time to tell this story, but, you know, when I was stationed in Germany from 1988 to 1990, in February of 89, my company put together a platoon to train with the French Army in Nancy, France, in a three-week school called French Commando School. Now, it's February, and the school was really just a bunch of obstacle courses. And the French cadre weren't like barking ass like drill sergeants. It was kind of like a gentleman's course. You know, they show you how to negotiate the obstacle. And you're like, you do, please, you know. You know, very low, laid back, you know. They weren't, like, dogging us or whatever. But I remember, I wasn't racially aware then. This was during the time of my life when I was nothing but a pussy, coward. I wasn't effeminate. There was nothing effeminate about me. I was just a fearful guy. So I'm going through this school, and I'm a sergeant. And I'm negotiating all these obstacles with great fear and trepidation. I become the laughing stock of the platoon. And, you know, and the French soldiers in the platoon started noticing, too. And I befriended a couple of them, and they were trying to, like, Mark, you can do this. Do this. No problem. You can do it. Well, I negotiated all the obstacles, but there was one. There was a steel platform. You walked off a 60-foot cliff. Well, it actually wasn't a cliff. The school was at a 13th century French castle, believe it or not. And it was a wall at the edge of a wall, a 60-foot wall of a 60-foot chasm, okay? And I had to walk out on this steel grated plank, and I got a belay line on, so if I start falling, they'll belay me, but I was just freaked out by this thing, and I had to jump off the edge of this plank onto a swinging pole in front of me. Now, I wasn't swinging real bad, but there was some movement to it, and it was about a meter and a half away from the edge of the plank, and I couldn't do it. And, you know, I'm up there, and I'm trying to jump, and I had a French cadre trying to sneak up behind me just to give me a kick in the ass to make me jump, and I freaking just couldn't do it. And that, you know what, and I still, maybe I'm an angry guy because of stuff like that. I have episodes like that. U.S. Army Air Assault School, I won't talk about that now, maybe later. But I couldn't do it, and I was the only one in my platoon not to earn a French commando crest. And they wouldn't even let me ride back to Aschaffenburg, Germany on the bus with the rest of the troops. I had to ride in the Dusenav trucks with the duffel bags and the gear and all that stuff. You know, and the other sergeants were just, you know, pissed off at me. I mean, just talking shit to me all the time. And when I got back to my company in Aschaffenburg, they moved me out of 2nd Platoon, put me in 1st Platoon, and no one in 1st Platoon wanted me. I was a freaking pariah, man, because of my cowardice. But what happened with that? From the minute I showed up at that school and I started looking at these obstacles, I let fear set in. And my lesson to you guys is this. Fear begets fear. Fear breeds more fear. You got to put fear in check. If you got to use the homemade acupuncture technique where you take the web of the webbing between your thumb and your index finger on your left hand, and you take your thumb and index finger in your right hand, you apply pressure there and hold it there for, like, I don't know, a couple of minutes and breathe deeply, close your eyes and meditate. It's supposed to, like, get rid of all stress. I don't remember if it's the web of the left hand or the right hand or maybe both. I don't know. But I heard it works like a charm. So I wasn't a racist back then. I didn't set a goal, number one. I didn't visualize me succeeding at my goal, number two. I didn't self-talk positiveness of me accomplishing my goal, number three. And I didn't use arousal control, deep meditative breathing, to conquer my fear. If those techniques can be used by Navy SEALs who do far more dangerous shit than we do, then it's good enough for us. And if you won't get your hands bloody, God damn it, at least get them dirty. The enemy has evolved. Learn from my mistake. I share that unflattering story myself because, in the scheme of things, guys, I ain't shit. I ain't never going to be shit. You know? You guys out there listening to this are the real deal. You guys are the superstars, not me. You know, when the final chapter of the white racist struggle is written, whether we win it or lose it, I don't even think there's going to be a paragraph dedicated to Ghost Wolf Radio. You know? And I'm fine with that. But to know that before I leave this terrestrial ball of mud called planet Earth, and know that before I leave it, that, man, we got an insurgency and it's growing. We got the Australian Aryan Partisan Army, the AAPA, killing Pakistanis and Lebanese people randomly because of what they're doing to Australian girls. That we are taking it to not only the invaders' asses, but more importantly to the men of commerce, to the guys who light their cigars with $100 bills. You fucks out there, you parasites, you vipers, and well-suited, well-heeled men and women who comprise the business apparatus and the global economy. You guys, Schadenfreude, I want to smile upon your demise, and I most likely I'm not going to live to see it, but to know that it's coming, you know, I can say, all right, well, my life was somewhat of a success. So I'm sure I'm going to share more failures with you guys that I've experienced. Learn from my failures, you young guys. You don't get racial tattoos like me. You don't wear bomber boots and braces like I once did. You don't talk nigger, spick, and chew, not even amongst your family. This is time for deep, deep cover. Lone wolf. We need to be serious about this. If you're not serious, if Ghost Wolf Radio is some sort of entertainment for you, fuck you. You are not a friend of mine or a comrade. Okay? I put together some techniques. I've talked about them. They've worked for me because I've done them. I've earned the right, I think, to come out of the shadows and give you guys this shit. Believe you me when I tell you, there's no reason why I shouldn't be sitting in a jail cell right now. Or I just incriminated myself? Maybe I'm just talking shit, FBI guy. But we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. I want to sign off every show from this point on, hopefully if I remember, with the term Carpe Noctem. Seize the night. No more excuses. We need to get busy. We need to get hot. We need to be faceless and nameless. We need to be in the shadows so we can make those contacts. Show no fear. You're always improving, always seeking improvement in your knowledge of information technology and weapons and knives. And I'm not much of a gun guy. I mean, I go shoot with my friends. I learn, you know, I'm a pretty decent shot, but I'm a blade guy. Because if the shit hits the fan, there's no more factories to make guns and bombs and bullets. We're going back to blades. Blades made from stone, wood, steel, ceramic. Become proficient with blades, disarming them and using them. So, 14 and Carpe Noctem.
Throughout history, there have been many songs written about the Eternal Triangle. This next one tells the story of a Mr. Grayson, a beautiful woman, and a condemned man named Tom Dooley. When the sun rises tomorrow, Tom Dooley must hang. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. I met her on the mountain, there I took her life. Met her on the mountain, stabbed her with my knife. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley, hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley, poor boy, you're bound to die. This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Hadn't it been for Grayson, I'd have been in Tennessee.
Well now, boy,
hang down your head, cry. Hang down your head and cry.
Oh boy, well,
hang down your head and cry. Oh boy, you're bound to die.
Well now, boy,
hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head and cry. Oh boy, you're bound to die. This time tomorrow, reckon where I'll be. Down in some lonesome valley, hanging from a white oak tree. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry.
How old was I when I first seen old Rivers? I can't remember when he wandered around. Well, that old fella did a heap of work. Spent his whole life walking plowed ground. He had a one-room shack not far from us, and, well, we was about as poor as him. He had one old mule he called Midnight, and I trailed along after him. He used to plow them rows straight and deep, and I'd come along there behind, busting up clods with my own bare feet. Old Rivers was a friend of mine. The sun would get high and that mule would work. Old Rivers would finally say, whoa. He'd wipe his brow and lean back in the reins and talk about a place he's going to go. He'd say, one of these days, I'm going to climb that mountain, walk up there among them clouds where the cotton's high and the corn's a growing, and there ain't no fields to plow. I got a letter today from the folks back home, and they're all fine, crops are dry. Down near them end, Mom said, son, you know old Rivers died. They're sitting here now in this new plowed earth, trying to find me a little shade. With the sun beating down across the fields, I see that mule, old Rivers, and me. Now, one of these days, I'm going to climb that mountain, walk up there among them clouds, where the cotton's high and the corn's a growing, and there ain't no fields to plow. With the sun beating down across the fields, I see that mule, old Rivers, and me.
On a cold, dark night, there was someone killed 'neath the town hall light. There were few at the scene, but they all agreed that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me. The judge said, son, what is your alibi? If you were somewhere else, then you won't have to die. I spoke not a word, though it meant my life, for I had been in the arms of my best friend's wife. She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. The scaffold was high and eternity near. She stood in the crowd and shed not a tear. But sometimes at night, when the cold wind moans in a long black veil, she cries over my bones. She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. Nobody knows but me. Nobody knows but me.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me, just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from a lot of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Well, I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fist got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man that gave me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I just hit town and my throat was dry. I thought I'd stop and have myself a brew. At an old saloon on a street of mud, there at a table, peeling stud, such a dirty mangy dog that named me Sue. Well, I knew that snake was my own sweet dad from a worn-out picture that my mother'd had, and I knew that scar on his cheek and his evil eye. He was big and bent and gray and old, and I looked at him and my blood ran cold. I said, my name is Sue. How do you do? How you gonna die? Yeah, that's what I told him. Well, I hit him hard right between the eyes, and he went down, but to my surprise, come up with a knife and cut off a piece of my ear. But I busted a chair right across his teeth, and we crashed through the wall and into the street, kicking and a-gouging in the mud and the blood and the beard. I tell you, I've fought tougher men, but I really can't remember when. He kicked like a mule and he bit like a crocodile. I heard him laugh and then I heard him cuss. He went for his gun to pull mine first. He stood there looking at me and I saw him smile. He said, son, this world is rough, and if a man's gonna make it, he's gotta be tough. And I know I wouldn't be there to help you along. So I give you that name, and I said goodbye. I knew you'd have to get tough or die. And it's that name that helps to make you strong. Yeah. He said, now you just fought one hell of a fight, and I know you hate me, and you got the right to kill me now, and I wouldn't blame you if you do. But you ought to thank me before I die for the gravel in your guts and the spit in the eye, because I'm the that named you Sue. What could I do? I got all choked up and I threw down my gun. Called him a pawn, he called me a son. And I come away with a different point of view. And I think about him now and then, every time I try and every time I win. And if I ever have a son, I think I'm gonna name him Bill or George, anything but Sue. I